Welcome back to Season 3 of Snubs and Dubs, where we're talking about the snubs and dubs of the 74th Academy Award for Best Picture. I'm your host, Kyle Tobiasen, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Miller. Jason, how's it going?
Kyle, it's going pretty good.
Yeah.
Basking in the glow of cinema as we have once again watched a movie and have come together to discuss it on a podcast.
Wow.
I know.
How are you doing? And we're going to a movie after. So watch a movie, talk about a movie, then go to a movie. Wow.
It's incredible. Like our life.
Sandwich.
We are cinephiles. That's for sure.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm vibing. Good. Sitting next to my brand new shelf. I got a little expansion into my Blu-ray shelf collection, and it feels good. It looks good.
It does look good.
I just love looking at it,
mm-hmm.
and it makes me happy just to sit here next to it.
This really works very poorly on a completely audio-based format, but viewers, listeners at home, imagine, if you will, a bookcase, okay? Now, place movies in there. And that's kind of what we're looking at. It looks good, though. It's a very large collection. It's an entire wall is just bookcases of movies. So
yes.
I guess when you're picturing a bookcase full of, picture like four of them.
Yeah. It's like 2.5 bookcases.
Yeah.
But like on a half wall. And so, but it like still, like each row is like 60 plus movies, which is a lot.
That's a lot of movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. It might be all of them. You might be coming close.
Did you watch anything in the last week?
I watched a little bit of stuff in the last week. We're getting the dregs of Spooky Week out
because
we're recording this early November, so it was still Halloween appropriate viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a funny coincidence, last year around this time, you had watched Hocus Pocus.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the first time you'd watched it?
The first one, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd seen the first one.
No, this was the first time that I had seen the first one. And I want to say that you may have undersold how weird this movie is. This movie's got a lot of stuff going on that I didn't expect in a Disney property. First of all, Sarah Jessica Parker, I don't know if she's inventing new categories of kink, but she's certainly reinvigorating them and deserves applause for that.
Yeah.
Her character was unbelievably horny for a children's Disney movie.
Which they toned down a lot in the sequel, but like in that original, she is very horny.
Very horny. They also invent a word, and I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they use the term yabos to refer to a high schooler's breasts. That's a new word. I looked it up because I'm like, no way on God's green earth has the term yabos been used before. So I Googled it, and Hocus Pocus invented that term for boobs.
Wow.
Now, lastly, third point. The main character, and now I will say, it is necessary to the plot that he is a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
What's not necessary to the plot is calling him a virgin 50 plus times. Every third sentence involves some throwback to him not having fucked ever. And it's actually kind of like a beatdown on this kid that they call him a virgin that many times in one movie. I don't know how they work it in 50 times. It must have been like... Oh, what's that movie called? It's like Troopers. I don't know. It's a movie with like police. They suck. They're just like really lame state trooper kind of thing.
Yeah, I think and I'm picturing it. I can't remember.
And they dare each other to say meow in a sentence however many times. That, but it's Hocus Pocus and calling a high schooler a virgin. It had the same feeling. They call him a virgin a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of unhinged in a weird way.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it because it gives it a level of interest that... I don't think you would get from modern Disney movie, which really shows in the sequel because they tone down the horny. And I don't think they mention how much of a virgin the main character is that many times.
Yeah.
It's mentioned because it's a crucial moment in the plot because to light the candle, you have to be a virgin to summon the Sanderson sisters, blah, blah, blah. But like, other than that, it's not like as much of a plot point.
That's one point in the plot. And they will, throughout the movie, it is just splattered with calling him a virgin. Other than that, though, I watched some, like, on Halloween, as kids were trick-or-treating at my door, I had some Simpsons Treehouse of Horrors in the background, so watched a bunch of those. They're fine. They're just kind of silly Halloween-themed stuff. They're not spooky. They're just kind of fun Simpsons stuff, so nothing too remarkable. Lastly, we started Guillermo del Toro's...
The Cabinet of Curiosities.
Cabinets of Curiosities... By glass,
Guillermo del Toro,
Gulag, the toilet. And it's pretty good. It actually has, it makes me feel like I'm a kid watching like Goosebumps shows or like Tales from the Crypt Keeper kind of thing. Like, it's actually well done. I've only watched the first two. I'm probably going to keep going because I'm enjoying them quite a bit, even though it's no longer Halloween season.
Yeah.
I will continue watching scary properties well into Christmas time because I refuse to watch Christmas properties till the 24th of December. I will do 1 to 2, but I've enjoyed it. I thought that's actually been pretty good so far.
Good.
Yeah.
In a weird parallel to how you also watched Hocus Pocus and I watched it last year. Last year, remember when we both watched Fear Street without talking to each other about watching Fear Street?
Yeah.
I also watched Cabinet of Curiosities on Netflix over Halloween. I got through the whole thing though.
Oh yeah. I only dipped my toes.
And I thought they were all pretty good. Like they do have like varying levels of quality. Like some are clearly better than others, but I do like the format. It is kind of Goosebumps for adults.
And it is. Yeah. It's like a modern Twilight Zone that doesn't involve the director killing people.
Yeah. And I like how at the start of every episode, Del Toro makes a point to like point out what the kind of theme is and who the director is. And they have like a little figurine of the director. And the collection of directors that they got are pretty interesting. Some of the later two episodes, I forget the guy's name, but the director of Mandy does an episode which is very low key, but also very in like, have you seen Mandy?
It's a Nicolas Cage movie. No, it doesn't even ring a bell, honestly.
Yeah, it's a crazy Nicolas Cage movie. And like, you can kind of get the same vibes from this episode. It's like super like through a filter in like hazy, grainy film look to it. But I really vibe with it. And it's not like the most scary thing for majority of it. A lot of it is just like five people talking for like the most of the episode. And then it kind of gets into some weird shit. But I liked that one a lot. And Jennifer Kent, who did The Babadook.
Yeah.
She has the last episode with Essie Davis returning.
Oh.
Not like return. It's not like a sequel to The Babadook, but they're teaming back up again. And I really liked that episode. I also I found it really touching. Like, I was like getting a little choked up at it.
Aww.
Like, I was surprised because I was like, oh, this is just like a spooky show for, you know, shits and gigs and some fun scares. But like that one, like, I don't know. It hit me. So I await your review of that one because I think that was probably my favorite one. What were the two of the first ones?
The first one was the guy who's buying warehouses because he owes some money.
Yeah.
And then shit goes from there. The second one was the graveyard with the rats.
Oh, yeah. That one was like, if you were claustrophobic, holy fuck, that would not be easy to watch.
What was funny was right like during while that one starts, my girlfriend and I was just like, imagine what's the worst way you think of dying? And then she said her thing. I think it was drowning.
Yeah.
And I said, without knowing where the episode was going yet, because at this point he hadn't really been underground. I said, my worst fear of dying, stuck in a cave.
Honestly, that's fucked.
Yeah. The episode would go on to involve that theme. So.
Yeah. And like a lot of other weird shit, like with rats and other stuff. But it was a cool episode. There's, I think the next one after that one is involving like an artist and painting. And the way that they handle the horror of it and the theme of it is like really unique in that it's a horror movie about art.
Oh.
But like it was super interesting and I really liked that one. It was really stress inducing, but that was a good one.
I hope it's just like this horror show is about an artist trying to pay rent. Ooh, you can't afford groceries and rent. Choose one.
Actually, no, they're quite wealthy. So,
oh, never mind. I don't want to see that. I want to see people successful from their from their craft.
But I hope they do more seasons of it because I thought it was a really cool format, and I think it allowed for some really cool kind of contained hour long horror stories that I would definitely dive into more of.
I would probably get hype as shit if they did like a season of that every Halloween.
Yeah,
I'd probably lose my goddamn mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. And Del Toro has his Pinocchio movie coming out soon, which I'm also very excited about.
Yeah, I kind of want to see that too. I want to see what he's done with this character.
The only other thing that I watched was I watched An American Werewolf in London, which is a like an 80s horror movie. It was good. It definitely has some sort of like old 80s charms. And it was really, I don't know if it was like early days for John Landis, but like it kind of had like a first feature type of vibes where it was like low budget horror, but they had a lot of cool like effects and stuff. And it also had like, it went to places that I didn't expect it to with like supernatural and like ghosts talking to the main character. But like the main character he's a werewolf. And so like there's some other weird like supernatural shit going on. And it's just, it kind of ended up being like funny in a way.
Like intentionally or no?
I think intentionally. Okay. It was kind of like unhinged in a wild way that it wasn't necessarily trying to be the most spooky movie. The most iconic scene from that is the transformation scene where like you see like the hairs growing out of him. And like it was crazy how they did it at the time with the budget they probably had. I didn't look too far into it, but like the practical effects that they used to make that transformation happen was amazing. And to have the werewolf itself looks kind of like, I don't know, more like just like a dog. So it was that was a little disappointing, but I liked it. It was fun.
Well, it is about the scariest monster of all, Kyle, an American tourist creature. Most of us couldn't even fathom in our wildest nightmares.
Yeah. But that was it. Other than this movie, of course, season 3 of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2001. And for episode 14, we are talking about Training Day. Had you seen it before?
No, but I knew of it.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke has something about him where you just happen to know every movie that he's in by some degree somehow.
Yeah.
He's just got this amazing kind of pull that the universe lets you know when Ethan Hawke's touched something.
Yeah.
It has a radiation effect that can be felt for years into the future. So I was aware of Training Day. I hadn't seen it though. Mm. How about you?
I also was aware, but hadn't seen it. It was one of those that I had like known I should probably watch at some point, but also I had this sort of like, I don't know, like it had a Michael Bay aura around it.
It did. It really did.
And I couldn't confirm that until I watched it. I don't know why I had that sort of assumption that maybe this was just like a dude bro type movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in ways it kind of is like, It's got like its typical action police movie, whatever, but like it was a lot more than that. And I was actually really impressed with it. So
yeah, I think right off the hop, it takes you down that alley, but it doesn't take you the full way down there. It turns left and then it's actually a more emotional movie and a lot more violent than, well, I don't know if it's more violent than like a typical dude bro cop movie,
but
it's a differently
violent. It is differently violent. Yeah. Like more impactful violence.
Yeah. More emotionally wrenching. It's not like, woohoo, shoot them guys. Yeah, it's more like, oh no, don't shoot them guys.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get into it. If you're interested in Training Day, I'm including links to the physical media related to it in the show notes. If you buy through that link, it'll help out our show. Or if you have any other Amazon shopping to do, follow the general link to help out our show in the process. A reminder, this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you haven't seen Training Day yet and you want to, go ahead and do so. It's on Netflix. I've also included time codes in the show notes so you can skip around to your heart's desire. But without further ado, let's get into it. Training Day is a 2001 American crime thriller film directed by Anton Fuqua and written by David Ayer. It is not based on, but is inspired by real-life events involving the Los Angeles Police Department's Rampart Division Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, or CRASH. Anti-gang unit. Although corruption in the unit had yet to been exposed when Training Day was written, Anton Fuqua had stated that the emergence of the scandal in the late 90s around the unit catalyzed the film's completion. Denzel Washington also grew a beard in order to emulate the appearance of a LAPD officer that was involved in multiple of the scandals. So it has tastes of reality, but like it also was being written before the reality happened. Yeah. So interesting.
What I like is the director probably just saw that unit and is like, oh, this is a safe bet. Let's make them corrupt as hell. This is not going to age poorly. I can feel this one going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess David Ayer grew up in like pretty bad neighborhoods and like experienced a lot of like crime and gang related stuff in his youth. So he had some real life experience in that area. So I think he was probably interested in this sort of subject matter before the real events happened. So this movie is starring Denzel Washington as Alonzo Harris, Ethan Hawke as Jake Hoyt, Scott Glenn as Roger, Cliff Curtis as Smiley, Dr. Dre as Detective Paul, I didn't even notice him, and Snoop Dogg as Blue in like a very brief cameo.
Yeah, it's even almost misleading to put it. It's more of like a, what's it called? Yeah, just a cameo. It's not even really a role. Well, no, he does roll, but it's a cameo.
Yeah. It is a runtime of 122 minutes, and after premiering at the Venice International Film Festival on September 2nd, 2001, it went wide on October 5th, 2001. Jason, what do you think of Training Day?
You know, it does, I think, intentionally mislead you into what kind of movie it's going to be so that you're paying closer attention as it shifts away from that.
Yeah.
I liked it. First of all, your acting duo, your main characters, like Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
You can put them in anything doing anything and they're going to get those two could make a two actor version of Willy Wonka, the Chocolate Factory. It'd be incredible. It would be moving and touching in ways the original wouldn't be. Like these two are going to give you great performances. Yeah. So that was lockdown solid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's an interesting movie. I think they do a really good job of making you wonder if Alonzo actually believes he's helping or if he's being crooked intentionally. And I think they hold that out on you very well until they're ready to give you the answer. And I was really into that.
Totally. And I think he's a very complicated character in itself, which Denzel brings so much to. Like, Denzel rocks this movie. Like, obviously, Ethan Hawke is there and he's doing a great job. But I think that my entire enjoyment of this movie lives and dies on Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
Because if you aren't bringing that sort of captivation into that character, you will completely lose this movie. And he carries it. And he also allows a sort of charm where you don't actually know if he's super all that crooked or like, and it allows you as well as with the writing to question it, because Denzel is also just like a very charming man and a great actor and has been known for being a very charming man in other movies. So to have that expectation put onto this very crooked and morally ambiguous man, it kind of plays with your expectations. And also, I think there was enough hints in the movie that he was good enough at some point and maybe still has that sort of belief that he is helping people, but he's just gone down this path so far that it has kind of corrupted him to the core and he's like can't escape that anymore. And it's really interesting. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, no, they're really great characters and they're portrayed very well, which carries this thing. You could have the worst movie possible and those two would bring life to it. So this being a good movie and then extremely well acted. They're not training, they're performing, they're giving, they're teaching.
Yeah, I do think Denzel can elevate this movie a little bit sometimes too, because at some points it's not the best well-written movie of all time. Like, it does like kind of have cliches and like bland dialogue.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see where it's going at parts, but like he really ties this whole thing together. And I think without him, this movie would probably not be the same at all.
I agree.
Well, do you want to read through the plot?
I'd love to.
All right, Jason's going to read straight through the plot. If you don't need the refresher, you can skip right to the discussion by following the time codes in the show notes. But here's Training Day.
Ambitious Los Angeles Police Department officer Jake Hoyt is up for promotion and is assigned to Detective Alonzo Harris, a highly decorated narcotics officer, for a one-day evaluation. Driving around in Alonzo's Monte Carlo, they begin the day by catching some college kids buying marijuana. Confiscating the drugs, Alonzo puts it into a pipe and tells Jake to smoke it. When Jake refuses, Alonzo threatens him at gunpoint, stating that refusing like this while on the streets would get him killed. Jake smokes the pipe, and then Alonzo tells him that it was laced with PCP. Gotcha. After paying a visit to Roger, an ex-cop-turned-drug dealer, Jake notices a pair of addicts attempting to rape a teenage girl in an alley. Jake intervenes while Alonzo watches. After the girl leaves and Alonzo scares the addicts off, Jake finds the girl's wallet on the ground and retrieves it. Later, Alonzo and Jake apprehend a dealer named Blue, finding crack rocks and a loaded handgun on him. Rather than go to jail, Blue informs on his employer, Kevin Sandman Miller, can never trust a Miller, who is in prison. Using a fake search warrant, Alonzo steals $40,000 from Sandman's home. At lunch, the two visit Alonzo's mistress, Sarah, and their young son. Alonzo then meets with a trio of corrupt high-ranking police officials he dubs the Three Wise Men. Aware that the Russian mafia is hunting Alonzo over a large unpaid debt, they suggest that he skip town. Alonzo insists that he has control of the situation and trades the $40,000 for an arrest warrant. Using the warrant, Alonzo, Jake, and four other narcotics officers return to Roger's house and seize $4 million from the premises, a quarter of which Alonzo keeps. Alonzo shoots and kills Roger when Jake refuses to do so and stages the scene with his men to make the shooting look justified. I mean, in today's world, as if you need that. Infuriated, Jake gets into a Mexican standoff with the corrupt officers. Alonzo, having planned the day's events, threatens Jake by reminding him of the LAPD's routine blood test, which will identify the PCP-laced cannabis Jake smoked earlier and end his career. Alonzo promises to protect Jake for his cooperation, and Jake is forced to comply. Later that evening, Alonzo drives Jake to the home of a Sereno gangster named Smiley for an errand. Jake reluctantly plays poker with Smiley and his fellow gang members as he waits for Alonzo. As they talk, Smiley reveals Alonzo's situation. By midnight, Alonzo must pay $1 million to the Russians for killing one of their men in Las Vegas or be killed himself. Realizing that Alonzo abandoned him and has paid Smiley to kill him, Jake attempts to flee but is beaten and dragged to the bathroom to be executed. Before they can kill Jake, a gang member searches him for money and finds the wallet of the teenage girl who happens to be Smiley's cousin. After calling his cousin and confirming how Jake had saved her, Smiley releases Jake out of gratitude. Jake returns to Sarah's apartment to arrest Alonzo, just as he is leaving to pay the Russians with Roger's money. A gunfight and chase ensues, and Alonzo is eventually subdued on the street while the entire neighborhood gathers to watch. Alonzo offers money to whoever kills Jake to no avail. Jake then takes the stolen cash, intending to submit it as criminal evidence against Alonzo. The neighborhood gang allows Jake to leave safely. Enraged, Alonzo threatens to retaliate against the gang members, but the unoppressed gang ignores him and walk away. Alonzo flees for his life to LAX, but he is ambushed and gunned down by the Russians. Jake returns home as the press reports on Alonzo's death. That is Training Day.
Wow.
Incredible. Now, I think where this movie kind of weakens, especially narrative-wise, is the third act.
Yeah.
First of all, it's a little flimsy that the girl that Jake saved is Smiley's cousin.
Yeah.
And they happen to find her wallet that he happened to have kept on his person through an entire day of insanity and never just like leave it in the car or something.
Yes.
They could have just had Jake escape on his own merit. I don't know why they needed to have that kind of overly cheesy karma pays off. He's a good cop. And because of that, he's allowed to go free. I don't know, man. You can go kind of buddy cop, shoot him up style on that point. I wouldn't mind. I'm not going to argue with that. He's about to go on a vengeance rampage against Alonzo anyways.
Yeah,
so.
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree because I also find that Alonzo's downfall is a little bit rushed, it seems.
Yeah, it is.
And also, I didn't completely understand why everyone was just standing there watching because it's implied throughout the movie that people at least have some respect for him or maybe just fear for him because of him being the police and not wanting to get implicated with the police. And so when they don't like help him afterwards, is that like going against his control that they've had over him for so long? And they recognize in Jake that he actually wants to uphold the law and not just like manipulate it and use it to his own advantages. But I don't know. It was just a little bit quick, I found.
Yeah. Now, on that point, they all hate Alonzo. There's like this one quick scene when they first go to the Sandman's house, I think.
Right.
And oh, no, when they first go to Alonzo's mistress's house and he like says hello to some people. And he's like, man, I saved that cousin from jail or whatever. Mm. And then the gangster's like, oh, hey, Alonzo. And then he walks away and that guy's like, man, I hate this. I hate Alonzo. Like he just kind of like talks to himself about how much he hates Alonzo. Mm-hmm. So I think like that's the only real interaction they have with this gang before that final standoff. So I think in like a not amazingly deftly written way, they're just kind of saying like, these people pretend to like Alonzo. They hate him. Wink, wink. They might come back later. And then at the end, they just don't care for him. So they're not going to help him out.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I do love that scene of him and Jake standing outside in that neighborhood, though. Obviously, it's just Denzel in his Oscar performance, right? Like, that was it. And the fucking King Kong ain't got shit on me.
Yeah.
That I'm sure people have seen, even if they haven't seen this movie. Like, it's just a great performance and a great speech. And I just thought, even though, like, I felt like it was pretty quick and I was kind of confused why they were just standing there, I was still captivated watching him.
Yeah. No, I think that was good. The whole time they're doing that, I am thinking, though, that Jake has mentioned over and over again that he has a wife and small young child he wants to get home to.
Yeah.
But then once he escapes Smiley, he's like, all right, time to one man army Alonzo, a guy known for murdering people and having a bunch of weapons. That didn't make much sense. He could have gone to the police at that point.
Yeah.
But also, it's a buddy cop action thriller at that point. I got to park that one in the not to be worried about. We're going to see some Denzel Washington action. Ethan Hawke's going to be chasing him down going pew pew. It's going to be great. Yeah. Turn the brain off and watch that.
Yeah, because they do have a fun chase scene at the end where they're, and well, they have a shootout at the house of the mistress and then followed by a chase scene. And that was kind of like your fun third act action set piece, just preceding the whole Denzel speech moment. And so I did think it gave you a good balance of actually good dramatic moments with still having the sort of buddy cop action that you might expect from this type of movie. I would be interested to watch it again because Alonzo, when he's just first meeting Jake, if you think about where he ends up and how this was all an elaborate plan, essentially, to get the money that he needed to pay back these Russians so that he could get off clean and not have to deal with the consequences of his actions, whatever those were, anger, alcohol, killing, whatever.
All of those.
Yeah. And so when you watch those earlier scenes again, because I did watch a few of them, you could kind of like think that he's just sizing Jake up to see how he will fit into this too. Because obviously he's gassing him a little bit and like bringing him through what he expects from Jake and is kind of hanging the carrot on the stick to get him to go to those places that he might not necessarily have gone and to push those limits to see if he will play into this plan and be a kind of a piece to get out of that consequence. So I don't know. It would be interesting to watch again.
Yeah. And I think, like, because Jake is so good and pure, wholesome, innocent boy, he actually has to change some of his plans. And I think that comes across interestingly, too, because I don't think he actually planned on killing Roger until Jake refused to take the money and he didn't have as much dirt on him.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference between threatening the blood test on someone who had already stolen money and now has that on it versus whether it's like, well, he just stole like $4 million. And you can see that you can pretty easily prove that he'd stolen $4 million. And if Jake's not throwing down and dirty with that, then he's probably a liability at that point.
Yeah.
So I think they do a good job of showing like the disagreement between Alonzo and Jake and how that kind of affects Alonzo's masterly crafted plan. And it makes a fun narrative the whole way through.
Yeah, it really does. This movie's also got like good cameos. Like obviously Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre are actual cameos. But Terry Crews is in this movie?
In a standing in the background role with no lines, which was hilarious.
Which I was confused by. I was like, damn, like that's a popular, amazing, awesome actor. Why is he just staying there not doing anything? And it's because this was his second movie.
Yeah, I kind of assumed that this would be like a super early Terry Crews before he really did anything.
And he wasn't even credited as in the role. Like I went to IMDb because I wanted to know, like this had to have been like an early extra role. And sure enough, it was like his second movie uncredited. But it was just, it's surreal seeing them because he doesn't say anything.
No.
But he's just Terry Crews.
And what's funny is like now a lot of the characters that he does is like, he looks tough, but really he's a big fluff ball.
Yeah.
So you're kind of waiting for him to break the character of being a tough henchman, but he is not that. So he's just going to stand there menacingly.
Yeah. And you don't get that other side because he never gets to open his mouth. He does get to clap for some birds, though.
Yeah. And that is pretty big.
Well, did you just want to hear what other people thought about this movie?
Yeah. Why don't you tell me what the people thought about this?
Rotten Tomatoes? 73% for critics.
Really?
Yeah. Audience is 89, though.
That's
so
better.
It does feel like kind of an audience-pleasing movie. I could see where critics might poke some holes into this.
Yeah, thing. It's not the strongest story, whatever. Yeah, totally. That's sure.
IMDb, 7.7. Metacritic, 69. Nice. So, yeah. I think mostly definitely an audience-type movie, which makes sense.
I imagine like this is still a pretty like well-written action movie, but I feel like this kind of shoot-em-up violent kind of thing probably doesn't pull as well with the critics.
Yeah, totally. And like I was saying earlier, this movie could easily fall apart if Denzel wasn't as strong as he was.
Yeah.
And so on a budget of $45 million, it made $104.5 million. So making back that $100 million more than, no.
60, yeah, yeah, like 60-ish.
I was like, that's an easy addition. But no, it's not. Yeah, so it did well, and it was 38th at the box office for 2001.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, like, they also, yeah, I could see how that movie runs that kind of budget with, like, big names in it.
Yeah.
And also, they did a lot of, like, filming in the streets, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I think I had a fact. I don't know if I wrote it down or if I just read it, but they made a deal with some of the gangs that were in that neighborhood that they were shooting in, that they were allowed to shoot in that neighborhood if some of the gang members were allowed to appear in the film.
That's kind of
fun. So, yeah.
In a really, like, violent, not fun at all way. It's like, morally not fun. But, like, if you kind of remove the humanity from it, that's kind of fun.
But more importantly, what are our scores?
That's a great question, Kyle. And unfortunately, you're starting it off again. What is your enjoyment of Training Day?
I gave this a 4. I was really captivated throughout the whole thing. And I thought that there was a lot to enjoy, except for like sometimes it was just a little bit hasty and maybe a little too thin.
Yeah.
About it.
Yeah, I'm going to give this a 4 as well. Like great performances. And it's just kind of, it has fun moments to it.
Yeah.
I was in it the whole time. So it's not a perfect movie by any means, but that is a 4 out of 5 if I've seen one. what's your craft?
I also gave this a 4. I was paying a close attention to the lighting because I was talking about lighting in a class that I was doing. But to have this take place over one day and to have consistent lighting that tracks throughout the whole day had to be so hard.
That had to have been annoying as hell.
And so like I think they really capture the streets and obviously the day thing. I don't know how much of that car stuff was on like a set or how much of it was actually shot in a real car on streets, but it did have kind of like a on locale dirty type of feel for the streets, which really suited the movie. And I thought it was really well shot too.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a lot to knock from it. I'm going to give it a 3.5. I just feel like there were some things that weren't as satisfying as they could be. Like it had Michael Bay feel to it, which I don't know if it was always needed, especially during the more like conversational bits that you wouldn't really need to have as dynamic a set around. I don't know. Yeah. Some of it didn't feel like it hit quite the right theme, and it was like a little too monotone in how it was trying to come across a bunch of different emotions and scenes. So I feel like they could have maybe had, I don't even know what to put into that, but it felt like the tone wasn't always what it needed to be to really take it to another level. So I'm going to just 3.5.
I also didn't notice the score or if there even really was a score.
Oh, there's like barely one. Yeah. There's like, but it wasn't like a well-crafted music piece that moved you with the movie. It was just kind of like, there's some music at parts when it's otherwise quiet. What's your execution?
I gave this a 4 as well. Denzel Washington really elevates this because his delivery of a lot of the dialogue, and as far as I understand, some improvisation as well, really elevated what might be a mediocrely written script. Like, it was kind of just like basic, like it comes together really well. But I think without the great performances from Denzel and also Ethan Hawke and some of the supporting roles as well, like it doesn't, it could also not come together. But for that, I gave it a 4 because it comes together really well in the end and the performances, unreal.
Yeah. I'm actually going to give this one a 5 for execution.
Damn.
Honestly, Denzel and Ethan Hawke could smooth over any issues that I had with the movie otherwise. Even if there were like plot points that didn't make complete sense, to Ethan Hawke and Denzel Washington, they were perfect.
Yes.
So I don't even care about that. Mm-hmm. That's a 5. They could, there was no issue too big for them to just smother over with themselves.
It was also surprisingly funny at times.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that was just all in the charisma and of the performances of the two actors. But yeah, it had some moments of like levity in this sometimes dark moments, but like it was, it just really worked. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what is your rewatchability?
Well, I kind of already mentioned that I was interested in going back, so I'm going to give this a 4. I'm interested in rewatching. I think it could be an easy rewatch. I think I might notice maybe more flaws or maybe different performance choices on a rewatch. So I don't know. I'm interested, curious.
That's fair. That's 4. I'm going to 3 it. I am open to watching it again, but I feel like a lot of my enjoyment came from the will he, won't he of Denzel Washington and crime. Mm. So now that I know what his whole intention and everything were, I don't know if I want to watch it again. Like, I don't know if I'm rushing out to see it, but like, oh God, if that's on in the background, I'm sitting my ass down and watching, learning. Definitely. So that is going to bring Kyle, your 4x4 in this for a 16 out of 20. And I'm going to be giving this a 15.5 out of 20. You're an 80%. I'm a 78%.
Yeah.
That's a, we liked it.
Yeah.
That's a good score right there.
Mm-hmm.
For ranking, Kyle, right now you're sitting at, in order, Donnie Darko, Memento, Royal Tenenbaum, Shrek, Ocean's 11, Harry Potter, Sexy Beast, The Others, Spy Kids, Monsters Ball, Gosford Park, In the Bedroom, Ghost World.
It's my new number 5 under Shrek over Ocean's 11.
Ah, Shrek is holding on pretty strong.
It is. It's got that ogre strength to hold on to these
it's
rankings.
It's got layers. I think I am going to be putting this as my new number 4, also just below Shrek and above Memento, which will bring my ranking to Donnie Darko, Royal Tenenbaum, Shrek, Training Day, Memento, The Others, Sexy Beast, Harry Potter, Ocean's 11, In the Bedroom, Spy Kids, Gosford Park, Ghost World, and Monsters Ball. I typoed Sexy Beast when I was writing mine in. I think I was just typing fast while looking up, and I wrote Secchi. Bear.
I saw that and I left it because I was like, that's just too funny. You know, Secchi Bear.
Secchi Bear stays.
You're also inching ever closer to Ocean's 11 being number 11.
It's getting real close. I only need 2 movies that are better than Ocean's 11 right now, and I think we can do it.
I think we can. Well, that'll bring us to fun Letterboxd reviews. It has a Letterboxd score of 3.8 out of 5.
Solid. Great. Pretty for good. Letterboxd.
This was kind of like a Letterboxd. A lot of it was just quotes and how good Denzel Washington was.
So good.
Which, it's reasonable, but come on. Give us the good stuff. I got 4 stars by Shay. If Denzel Washington raised his voice at me, I'd probably start crying. I'm shaking. I just thought of it.
Honestly, yeah.
Yeah. This is 4 stars by returning Ben 10 fan Diamond Bolt. My first day at Walmart was like this.
I think it's specifically like it's part of training to smoke PCP laced marijuana just to really get into the team feel.
Yeah. All right. 2 stars by Peter. Don't do drugs. It'll make your vision green. That was so weird. I get that it's kind of like the common thing in movies sometimes where people are high on weed to just like turn the screen green, but it's just such an odd choice.
It doesn't make sense. This also speaks volumes of what you can do while on drugs. It kind of comes off, I think, unintentionally pro doing drugs on the job, because Ethan Hawke, he does great.
Highly functional.
Yeah.
All right. And lastly, 4 stars on a rewatch by Olivia. I was 6 years old in 2001, so let me just get this out now that I am older and have a functioning brain and can recognize these things. The fact that Ethan Hawke was run as supporting and Denzel as lead is category fraud of the highest order. It is his titular Training Day, which brings us perfectly to the Academy Award details.
Well, okay. Well, hold on. Training is either the act of giving or receiving training. So, Olivia, check the dictionary before you go on Letterboxd.
Okay, well, yes. So that will bring us to the Academy Awards. So it did, in fact, get 2 nominations.
Mm-hmm.
Best actor, Denzel Washington. Best supporting actor, Ethan Hawke.
Okay. I will say, maybe in terms of screen time, Ethan Hawke probably did have more screen time. But when the two characters are interacting, there's a clear dichotomy of who's in control of the situation and who's like riding shotgun with that.
Yes.
So I think if you want to take a look at like textbook definitions of leading and supporting, yeah, okay, maybe it's weird. But like having watched that movie and heard that, I'm totally fine with that personally. Yeah.
I also do feel okay with it because it does feel like they share an equal amount of screen time, despite Ethan Hawke, in fact, having more screen time in total. Denzel did win Best Actor for this year.
Yeah, so. And like, that's the other thing. I didn't know he got Best Actor, but having seen the movie, I knew he was the best actor of that year, so he deserved to get it. I don't care what hijinks of categories were required to make that happen.
Well, there's going to be one big competition that we'll get to later in the season. Denzel's win at the Academy Awards for Best Actor was considered a major upset at the time, as fellow nominee Russell Crowe had won all the major precursor awards, the Golden Globe, the Screen Actors Guild, the Critics' Choice, and the BAFTA for A Beautiful Mind. So we're going to have to keep that in mind as we inch closer to the Best Picture winner. But yeah.
We'll keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. Russell Crowe better bring it.
Yeah.
Like, he needs to be bringing some kind of firepower we haven't seen before, because that was Denzel Washington, the clinic.
Yeah. Other notable awards, Denzel was nominated for the Golden Globe and the SAG. Obviously, those went to Russell Crowe. He did win the MTV Movie Award for Best Villain, and Snoop Dogg won for Best Cameo, which is funny because after Zoolander, we knew what the competition was.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting facts. I got a few here. The line, "King Kong ain't got shit on me," was ad-libbed by Denzel Washington.
That's pretty sick. I'm glad that that's kind of what's going on in his mind, that he like often is just comparing himself to King Kong. And in that moment, he was ahead by a mile.
Yeah. And it is the most iconic line from this movie by far. And he just like put that out there. Goddamn. Yeah. Legend. Tobey Maguire was seriously considered for the part of Officer Jake Hoyt. He even followed undercover narcotics officers in Los Angeles for 2 months and gained weight for the role. He was dropped when Ethan Hawke, the director of Fuqua's first choice, was finally available for shooting schedule.
That is really funny.
Yeah.
That just kind of feels like a very Tobey Maguire thing to have happen. Like, he spends all this time researching the role, and then Ethan Hawke just like has a free calendar
I'm available and he gets booted. He was okay though, because after this, he got Spider-Man.
So. Good for Maguire. He deserved a break of some kind.
Yeah. So yeah, this was the point that I had earlier. T. Rogers, the founder of the Black Peace Stones Bloods in Baldwin Village, aka the Jungles in Los Angeles, was on set for all the filming in his neighborhood and allowed the producers to use his neighborhood in exchange for casting gang members. So yeah.
Again, morally gray, but fun. It's a movie. Don't think about the real world consequences.
Yeah. So this is more of a movie fact instead of a fun fact about this movie in particular. But the coffee shop in the beginning of the movie, which was incidentally the first scene shot, is the same shop that is used in Seven, in the scene where Morgan Freeman meets Gwyneth Paltrow to talk. In the windows in both movies, the writing reads "Quality Cafe." The Quality Cafe is also used in Gone in 60 Seconds, Ghost World, and Catch Me If You Can.
Damn.
So it's a busy cafe for movies, I guess.
I like to think of them all existing in the same universe. Yeah. And like everyone's appearance in that cafe was like over one like particularly strange week. Just like one real fucked up week in that city.
Yeah. All right, so these are some real life facts. The Rampart investigation, based mainly on statements of admitted corrupt crash officer Rafael Perez, initially implicated over 70 officers in wrongdoing. Of those officers, enough evidence was found to bring 58 before an internal administrative board. However, only 24 were actually found to have committed any wrongdoing, with 12 given suspensions of various lengths, 7 forced to resign into retirement, and 5 were terminated. 70 were implicated, mm-hmm. 5 were fired.
That, and none faced jail time. Are you kidding me?
Absurd. As a result of the falsified evidence and police perjury, 106 prior criminal convictions were overturned. The scandal resulted in more than 140 civil lawsuits against the city of Los Angeles, costing the city an estimated $125 million in settlements.
Yeah, that, oh, there's a discussion about feelings about the police force. That, yes. That maybe doesn't have a place here,
yeah.
But that should be criminal. They should just invert it. You know what? Yeah. Take every prisoner right now. They're now the prison wardens, and take all the cops, and they're now the prisoners.
Yeah.
Just, is that any worse? Test it for like a week, and if it's not worse, leave it.
Yeah. I will also say that a lot of the lower end letterbox review scores were just people saying all cops are bastards.
Sort of thing. Probably a lot of people grabbing a cab in the comment section.
Yeah. But any final thoughts on Training Day?
I did think it was funny that this is the second ever mentioning of Rodney King in Snubs and Dubs history, with the first being Jingle All the Way.
Oh, I love that. It's entrenched in our history now. Amazing. Yeah.
And again, for a movie that says, like, oh, we don't do that Rodney King shit anymore, they pulled off a lot of Rodney King level stuff. Yeah, a lot of those activities were police brutality a la Rodney King. So. Yeah. How about you, Kyle? Any last thoughts?
Oh, God, no. I don't have anything else to say. It was a good movie, though. Yeah. I think people should check it out.
Me.
I like it,
too.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for listening to Season 3, Episode 14 of Snubs and Dubs. As always, you can find us everywhere on social media at Snubs and Dubs. That's on Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd, etc. We're also on Good Pod, so make sure to check us out there and join our official Discord. We'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on Training Day or on this episode. So please send us a tweet or a message with a question, recommendation, or anything else. I'm also at Kyle Tobias on Twitter, and Jason's at Wendy_Mills. Of course, all of those links will be in the show notes. Make sure to leave a 5-star review, share the show to everyone you know, and check back next week for another episode. Here's a sneak peek of the film we're going to talk about.
Legend tells of a ring created by an ancient evil that gave its wearer the power to enslave the world. Believed lost for centuries, it has now been found.
Is it secret? Is it safe?
This is the One Ring, forged by the Dark Lord Sauron. Sauron needs only this ring to cover all the lands of a second darkness. He's seeking it. Seeking it all. His thought is bent on it.
No one knows it's here, do they? Do they, Gandalf?
That's right. It's the big one, baby. Next time we're talking about Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. So make sure to watch it before next episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap. Bye.
Bye for now.